Hello, friends. Welcome back to the Dry Side Dispatch. And just Dusty and I in the studio today with our friend Nick. Everybody probably remembers Nick.
Hey, everybody.
Andy's all out doing his landman thing today. So he's headed to the courthouse, to a courthouse in an unknown location.
Everybody,
in a secret locale.
If you happen to be in the courthouse somewhere, in the basement of the courthouse somewhere, and you see Andy, say hi.
Yeah, that's exactly right. He's out there. Not too many courthouses left that you have to go to and do research anymore.
No.
Not if it's online anymore, which is really nice. Makes it nice not to have to travel to all of the foreign parts where most of our oil is. Speaking of which, I spent the week in Midland. Speaking of foreign parts.
How was it?
It was good. Went to the Produce Water Society's 36th annual conference in Midland, Permian Basin. I was like, dawning on me that they've been having Produce Water conferences for 36 years. That's three and a half decades.
Yeah.
And we're still waiting on permits.
Well, to be fair, we haven't been waiting for 36 years, but...
Well, it's true. It's true.
It's just like, you know, you'd think, man, we wish we were a little bit closer to the finish line after 36 years.
Yeah, it was interesting. I will say, I started going, I think this was my third or fourth year to go. And interesting, just to see the development, how much has developed in 4 years. So, you know, this time last year, I was still like, yeah, we're still a ways out, I think. And now I'm like, okay, like, this is the first time I'd ever heard, like, people that actually are saying, oh, yeah, no, we can do this at scale. We can, it works now. It's economical. There's multiple ways to do it. But also, there's all conversations about, you know, lithium and all of the different, you know, things that you can get out of mine of the water.
Yeah.
And I thought interesting, Senator Perry said that they're looking at legislation to make sure that somehow that those owners, those minerals owners, get to benefit from the minerals taken out of the water.
Yeah.
So that would be...
Well, they should. I mean, that would be, and that would also be another big financial driver to it, because, you know, there is altruism, but altruism is fantastic, but altruism is driven by dollars.
So, interestingly, what I think is interesting about this is that, like, these are all... you know, critical minerals that are extremely valuable because of their scarcity.
And they're predominantly mined in under horrible conditions in third world countries. Mm-hmm. And they're just, I mean, it's terrible. Yeah.
So some of them, though, like, there will be so much, like, you can have so much of it that's mined out that it actually will drop the value of the, you know, and there's a few where there's enough space in there that they'll still hold,
that
you know, it'll still be
supply
worth.
The won't exceed demand,
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, produced water is one of the things that just fascinates me. I mean,
it is really crazy.
I mean, that, to me, that would be, I mean, that's like amazing.
We got to hear a really...
the upside of that.
Brilliant tech PhD student discuss her research on the impact of produced water, so completely treated produced water and partially treated produced water, like what they call polished. So like desalinated and then cleaned, and desalinated or not cleaned, but that polished. That's the word that they use. To me, it just means like cleaning it up the rest of the way. But anyway, but she's been using it on soil and looking at the impact on soil and soil health.
That's very interesting.
On the microbial population, really interesting. And so she is going to join us.
Ooh.
I know. And so we'll have to be ready to ask some really smart questions
or
translate her smart answers into something we can understand. Because I do admit, like 90% of the time I was sitting there going, this sounds like Charlie Brown's school teacher to me. I don't. This is way over my head. Way over my head. So...
It would be, you know, I think something nice to be able to use the produced water in a meaningful economic way. And I do remember seeing some chatter around the idea that maybe this is something that, you know, you can pair up with the data center industry.
Yeah.
you know, use in that way.
Yeah.
And I feel like this was a Tribune article, but, you know, when you sort of think of the scale in terms of how much produced water there is versus how much, you know, capacity for water data centers require, it's like still not too much, right? You know, it's like the amount of water that you require, it doesn't really... It'd be cool if it was just one for one, you know.
Yeah, and right. It's like, right.
Problem solved, right? Produced right. water can fix all that.
Well, the problem is data centers aren't necessarily where produced water exists.
Well, some of them are. Some of them, and then they're thinking that way for sure. And you know, one of the
that was frightening. I'm not.
Well, sure. Something just dropped off the wall. So, my goodness.
This is my scared face.
That was one of the things that was suggested, but what I was there speaking on a panel about rangeland restoration with it. And to me, you know, when you're looking at what's the thing that could have the greatest long-term impact, if you look at taking it and using it in the Permian area to restore the grassland in that area and the rangeland, because they were talking about, and Eric Bernard, who is also going to join us. I just have to nail him down on a date. He is just an expert. He's just spent his career studying this, and he's the landscape architect, which means basically not your yard. It means like huge regions of areas. And so he's really studied like what that would look like, and you know, taking that and letting it infiltrate over the course of like 10 years. And so like, you could put it into a river and it would, you know, keep the river flowing until there's no more produced water, which it will peak in like the 2030s is what they're saying. So you have peak and then it's gone. Or you can infiltrate that and begin to really recharge. And then that recharge actually eventually is what will recharge those. It will go down and into those streams. And it makes it begins to recreate the cycle of especially rain. And so he was talking about a lot of different, you know, places that they've done this in China and in Africa, where they've just spent the time to do some restoration, like large scale landscape restoration, and how it's beginning to change just the environment of the surrounding area and bringing back more rain potentially.
Wow.
So that would be amazing.
I just want to, I just want to feel like I'm not living in a Larry McMurtry book right now.
Right.
I would love to have rain everywhere, but
I know.
The biggest tease on the planet. We went out to eat and drove through three different places where it had rained, looked like the second, you know, looked like a Noah's Ark again. And then you go 100 foot and it's like dry as a bone.
I know.
I'm like, man.
Yeah, I was coming home watching that from Midland and just thinking, you know, I wonder how long it would have to rain before I would get tired of it.
Mm.
Now, I will say like flooding is scary.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But I don't know. I think I could like live somewhere where it just rained every afternoon. Cool things off.
I can handle that.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
Oh, yeah.
But on the produced water, one of the things that we talked about, you know, we're talking about how they pump it in, we're running out of pore space. You were talking about running out of produced water peaking in 2030s. I'm like, well, why don't we just start pumping the stuff that we've shoved back down into the pore spaces again back out and redo it? And then.
Well, and a lot of it, I mean, that's where most of it's going right now, it's recycled and used for fracking.
Yeah.
A lot of it is, you know, that's the most, you know, that's the easiest thing for them to do. But I did talk to one company that's looking at, this is exciting to me. They're looking at doing Ply Lake, putting it in Ply, you know, once it's cleaned.
Yeah.
We're not ever talking about anything that's not cleaned and treated, you know, but putting it back into. And I was like, I love that idea because that is.
Isn't it under the fastest recharge? The Clean Water Act?
It doesn't really have any. It doesn't have anything yet. That's probably the problem.
If you're dumping it out on the ground, that's not fun then.
Well, you would think.
Yeah.
I mean, if it was just the Clean Water Act, if we could just use that, we would already be using it. Because you can get it, it is literally cleaner than most of our municipality drinking water.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, if people, you can compare the two, but, I mean, and it can get that clean, but it can get too clean, you know, where, and that's what I learned from this, which I mean, I kind of knew in the back of my mind that that was true, but like if you treated it completely and got it, you can get it to the level of distilled water. And holy so cow. You can't drink distilled water for a long time because it just doesn't. It doesn't provide the minerals that your cells need. Mm. And so it will do the same thing to the soil. It just will just deplete. Eventually, it will just, after about 10 years, would strip the soil of all of its nutrients.
Well, putting it into putting it into a plow would be, seemed like that would be a fantastic idea.
It would be lovely. I was so excited to hear this guy say that they'd already looked at this and they'd already asked TCEQ if it was possible. And, you know, so they're really thinking about it. I'm not saying they're going to do it next week because it's, you government. Know, it's, we're still, there's still a lot of work to do on the permitting process. But to me, it's super encouraging to hear someone's thinking that way. And anyway, so I'm excited to connect and see what happens there. That's really, really cool.
That's going to be, that's, I mean, that's such an exciting, you know, in a good way. You know, it's it's nice to say, oh, this is an exciting deal, and it not be like, it's exciting like a tornado coming at your house. Right. But, I mean, this is actually something that's, you know, there's optimism out there. There's, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel that does not appear to be an oncoming train. You know, it, there's options out there. There's people, good people, looking at at solutions that are going to be that can be beneficial to a broad swath of the populace.
I think that's the thing to me about when you look at, and one of the, on the panel that we had on rangeland, one of them is the president of the South Texas Landowners Association, and Charles, he's somebody we should have on. He's really interesting, but he's been really trying to push, like, if we can do things that have a short-term benefit, or we can do something that has a long-term benefit, you know, and this is something that will have that long-term benefit. And he was like, and I, you know, what we know now, like a lot of these data centers, you know, they're going to use some of that water and that's going to get recharged. He said, well, why don't you partner with them? Let them use the first set of it. They clean it up. Then we put it out on the land, you know? Mm-hmm. And, and I think, you know, it, and it's interesting now, people are finally catching on to, like, the fact that ag really uses the majority of our water, and it's interesting to hear people's, to hear people say that and start to catch and understand that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's not, sometimes I laugh when I'm there, because I tell them, I'm like, we're the two, like, ag and oil are the two most vilified, like, you know, in ag, it's like we've been raping your soil and poisoning your cereal your whole life. I'm so sorry. You know what I mean? I'm so sorry about that. You know? And so it's like,
well, the thing,
be
the thing
nice
about
to
is,
see the these the, two things do, these two industries do something together, because it never is as bad as you think it is.
I mean, that's, but, you know, everybody, say, you know, like that. But I mean, there are huge swaths of this country that would be unpopulated without ag and oil.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, there's a huge chunk of the prosperity of this country would be gone.
Without the oil in the Permian Basin, then that's like, my gosh, isn't it like 70% or something of the oil in the United States?
Oh, it's huge, right? And I mean, it's also just a massive component of the Texas economy.
Yes.
Right? I mean, you know, when you think about, you know, why is Dallas such a large financial center, right? You know, and these things. And there's so many, even industries that aren't necessarily directly related to oil, there's just so many spillover effects that sort of come with that. Right?
Yeah.
It really has shaped the nature of the state. It would be hard to envision what Texas would be if it didn't have oil.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Well, and that's the thing. But, you know, Texas is what everybody thinks about. I mean, that's the number one thing. But the Dakotas, the same. Of course, I mean, North Dakota is, they're primarily a harder type of oil to get out, so it's a bigger deal. But I mean, it's not as big an industry. Pennsylvania is one that Pennsylvania is one I never remember. You know, that there's actual oil in Pennsylvania. I never remember that. I mean, I just think Yankees and light coasters is a thing. So, and you don't think about that, but you know, you look at the I'm in cotton country, and I'm wearing
polyester,
a little bit of cotton, but my shirt is not. You know, it's like, and so
we should have like some kind of like sign on the door that says no cotton, no entry. Yeah.
I would have to replace a lot of my wardrobe because I wear this stuff a lot. But
oh, my goodness.
I like the fact that it dries out when I'm drinking water. And
yeah.
But I mean, there's a lot of upside I see in the future of the produced water. And it's, you know, it's 10 years ago when you talk about produced water, the hills that it had to climb just seemed insurmountable.
Oh, I wouldn't say it wasn't even that long ago.
I mean,
it was 4 years ago. I can remember the guy that he's the one who moderated our panel. And I remember the first time I met him was at a different conference, and we were sitting around, and he was like, does anybody know if there's a solution? And this was probably 4 years ago at all. Does anyone know? Is there a solution that is cost effective? And everybody's just like, crickets, total crickets, you know? And he was like, well, you know what? At some point, it won't matter if it's cost effective. If we don't, it's going to have to be done, you know? And I think that's kind of leads into like some of the stuff. When I was texting Nick, he was like, what do you want to talk about? I was like, well, I always want to talk about something that's a little bit on the edge. Make people think.
Sure.
Like, when I was at NASA, and I think I may have mentioned this last week, yeah, about how much the yearly impact, billions of dollars, that a satellite from 1970s still brings to the U.S. economy, and how what's the balance and what's the relationship that, you know, we should strive for in government oversight and government influence and spending to what we were just discussing before we turned on the air of to promote the general welfare of people, you know, that supports, you know, the ability for people to achieve the American dream, you know. And part of that, I think, is what do we invest in regulations, and what do we invest in, I guess, the carrot or the stick, you know, and does that have good returns for us, you know? And I know it's kind of on the scale of, I guess, what different people believe of how much you should spend or not.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to, that's why I wanted Nick to talk about, just like, where do you see the benefits, and some of those benefits that can't even be, they're not monetary. You can't, you know, they may actually have down the line, you may see, and I know this is true, like with green spaces, like in 2 years after you've invested $103 million to redo streets and parks and whatever, you're not going to see like some improvement next year, but you can see these long-term impacts on health.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, and it's I think the first part there is, you know, you have to have the ability to define like what the benefit is, right? And there are some things where we have data for, some things that we don't,
mm-hmm.
that allow for us to say, you know what, there's something you can really hang your hat on here, you know. And green space is a great example because we have property values, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you can see the impact of, you know, the percentage of green space in an area, investing in green space, and the impact that that has on the desirability of the area, right, based on essentially property value. And so if you're taking a sort of modern approach to thinking about your community, there are a lot of clear arguments that you can make for public amenities and how as a community that you actually get a return on your investment by getting those, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of those arguments, or part of that argument, was used in the process of, you know, reforming aspects of downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And one element of that I'm very excited about is the downtown park, right?
Mm-hmm. Pickering.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the downtown park and what it potentially will do for the surrounding businesses around there in terms of creating activity, right? There's a really great coffee shop nearby. And just thinking about, oh, how much more walk-in traffic are they going to get as a result of that? There's an amazing development that's happening across the street from the park that's going to be Lubbock's first sort of food hall concept.
What is that called? I think I was down there by it. I saw a sign for it.
Oh, they put up the sign. Yeah, it's what is the name? But yeah, it's gonna be if you haven't seen one of these in other cities, you know, I want to say that
Denver has a great one.
Yeah,
it's called Central Market.
Central Market.
We go there every time.
And I want to say if I'm remembering correctly that the folks that actually helped to design the structure of this one that's going to be in downtown. We're affiliated to the Denver design of that one.
Broadway Market.
Yeah, Broadway Market. And so you think about the investments that the private sector, right, the people who are developing that property, you think about the investments that they're making, they're huge. Right? That
yes.
building, whoa, I mean, was...
Yes, I passed by, last week. It's down to bare bones.
Oh, yeah. But
they're
that's,
getting it. Right?
And that's the thing is... any time that you think about downtown Lubbock and, oh, we've got to do something, look at these buildings, we've got to invest in them, make things change, things like that, the thing you have to take into account is that so many of them have asbestos in them.
Oh, yes.
And so your ability to do anything with those buildings...
is not instantaneous.
Right? The price of redevelopment skyrockets.
Yeah.
And so as a result of that, you have this waiting game of, okay, I need to see market signals... that people are going to come downtown if I do this, if I really take the plunge, because these costs, I don't get them back, right? If I take out the asbestos in this building and people don't start showing up, right, you know, what have I done? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when being able to look at some kind of value, right, when you have data there, and there's even really great work on bigger picture things, right? So the national parks, right? Have value,
yeah.
right? The national parks have enormous value,
yes.
right? But you have to really think about, okay, well, how do we quantify that? How do we quantify the economic benefits of tourism, the things that happen for the communities nearby the parks, the overall sort of benefits to community, things like that, right? And so it makes it difficult in casual conversation to say this is something we should have, right? Because the easy part. To look at is how expensive it is.
Yeah.
Yes.
The hard part is to quantify the benefits of it. And that's, I think, where the challenge becomes in society is whenever you're trying to make the case for doing something new, having that ability to say, well, there's a there's an element to this where we're going to get this back, right? Mm-hmm. And to have people feel as though that is true,
yeah.
you know, ends up being part of the sell.
Because it's easy to say, oh, well, you know, This is going to be good for the city or for the state or whatever. But it's then like, okay, how? Well, it's just going to be good. I mean, that's not an answer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, you know, and like you said, it's you know, I don't think that national parks the benefit that everybody gets from a national park is not it's from a government standpoint, it's a net loss.
Yeah.
Their use fees do not cover.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Cover. They're not going to.
Right.
But what Yellowstone does for Jackson and Victor and all those little towns along the border in Montana and stuff, what it does for them is huge.
Right.
I mean, you could literally say, you know, on Jackson's got skiing, but, I mean, it's still probably... 3/4 of the people that come to Jackson don't come skiing because they're up there now and they're not skiing now, you know, and it's, you know, you go down to Jackson in May when there's no snow and it's still a madhouse.
But I think there's enough evidence too out there to say that the people that come receive benefits from being there, from being in the outdoors and experiencing things that can't. Sometimes you just can't even quantify.
Oh yeah, right. That. And these, and you know, what we're talking about right now are just like public goods, right?
Yes.
Things
yeah.
like
right.
having a park, right?
Right.
Stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you're thinking about it more from a market approach, right? And how to develop that, capitalism only works when there's markets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And whenever you're trying to do something new, supply and demand don't necessarily match.
Right? Yeah.
And so in those periods, produced water is a great example. You know, when you get to scale, when you're able to really do these things at large volumes, the cost of producing that water and cleaning it goes down significantly.
Right.
And you can math that out and show it.
Yep.
But if you don't have the financing to get from here to there,
you're
never going to get to that scale.
Well, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I mean, it's like when MySpace started. The first, you know, there was no market for it until it existed. Because
right.
you know, how can you have a market for something that's never existed before?
Right.
You know, and so mm-hmm. you know, it's a chicken the egg type deal, but somebody's gotta step off there and, you know, write the first line of code.
Oh yeah.
In it. But I mean, but there's also from the journaling back down to a city perspective instead of trying to do a nationwide yeah. perspective.
Well, this park is a good place. I mean, this is a good place for us to start is all this investment here.
You know, mm-hmm. I lean more towards the Rand Paul side of the political spectrum versus the AOC side. I figure those are two disparate, you know, far enough apart. My joke has always been, I want the government to make the roads, deliver the mail, and secure the border. That's my goal. That's what I'm. But I mean, that's hyperbole. That's just talking. But when you look at what the city planners had done, when you're laying out city in the city, and you watch, Lubbock has done in my opinion, over the last 35 years, has done a remarkably poor job of planning how subdivisions are going to be built in their town, mm-hmm. in our town, mm-hmm. because we live in, I live in Northwest Lubbock. There is a park within a mile of my house, mm-hmm. a park, and it is only exists because it's got a ply lake in it that's too deep for anybody to use.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
and that's the only reason it exists. Mm-hmm. And if I could go back in time and wave a magic wand, every subdivision would be built and say, you got to have at least one block sized city park.
Right.
And the developer you're in charge of paying for it. You know, especially now that we're footing the bill for all the streets and everything and giving developers that benefit of that money, it borders, it's so bad that it makes me think that everybody that's ever served in city government anywhere is on the payroll of somebody.
Right, you know, but it's such a good example in that with a little bit of foreplanning, you know, I mean, the classic example, and this was if you're enjoying controversies, this was a controversy recently, was the alleyways, right? So it's mm-hmm. a very similar story.
Yeah.
You know, cities are empowered to say you need to pave alleyways.
Yes.
Cities are empowered to say if you're building a new subdivision, there has to be X percentage of it has to be green space. Right? Yeah. You can that, right?
No, later. I believe, around, Pastor, you're preaching to the choir.
Exactly, right. Like there are absolutely no limits, you know, to those types of things. You know, communities are empowered to make those choices.
Yes.
And the leadership that we have had, right, historically doesn't see the value in having and shaping it in that way,
yeah.
right? And it even, I mean, there's even simpler things. You know, going back to the conservation, when you're building a house, there is not a large financial difference between traditional plumbing infrastructure or setting the plumbing up of that house for gray water.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right? For gray water
yes.
capture, right? But if you are in a community where your plumbers have never had to do it before, don't
right.
know how to do it, right?
Yeah.
They're not gonna, right? And developers have never, they're just not gonna do it.
Right.
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 But as a community, do you benefit from separating gray water from other water in mm-hmm. order for that gray water to be used for other purposes, right? To capture mm-hmm. it, right? Separate it, you know, right? Use
yeah.
it in your own home, irrigate with it, whatever, right? 100%. But until as a community, you make that choice and say, okay, this is the way that we need to do it, nobody will do it.
Right.
right? And it's those are the sort of the challenges of mm-hmm. when you see these types of benefits and recognize, oh, this is something we probably should be doing, but unless there's like a little kick here to get people going on it, right?
Right. Yeah. Right.
Because again, you know, with gray water plumbing, it's just which pipes do you connect to
That's
which
right.
pipes, right?
Yes.
It's not different pipes.
Yes.
It's not a right. It's just making sure that when you connect the pipes, you're connecting the right ones to the right ones, right?
Right.
And but you don't let them mix. You know?
It's then it's not rocket surgery or even brain science.
Yeah.
But you know it's almost like nobody involved in the city in the last 30 or 40 years has ever played Sim City.
That's like, funny.
You know it's you know and you it's funny because you know you did that as a kid, you do that and you're like, oh well that's an epic train wreck. And so then you play it and you start over again. Well, you can't delete a city and start over
right.
again. You got to function with what you've got. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we could have put a line in the sand and said, hey, you know what? Neighborhoods look better if the alleyways are paved
yeah.
or mm-hmm. you know, put cement in the alleyways. It looks
right.
better.
Mm-hmm.
Everything looks better. You know, hey, the Devil Strip, let's, you know, move the sidewalk over there so that we got a continuous lawn. And hey, let's have everybody, let's say, do rainwater capture.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, even on a small scale, mm-hmm. where you've just got a couple of, you know, 55-gallon barrels out there catching water, and it's got a spigot at the bottom of it, you just open it up and water your houseplants. Yeah. Think about what you save. Mm-hmm. And you're cutting down on the amount of water that runs off your place. You're cutting down on what's running down the streets. And so I would assume that you're going to reduce wear and tear on your streets to some level, because like my street now, when you drive down Milwaukee after a good rain, those two roads next to the curb are flowing curb high, because, you know, we're a flat, this is predominantly flat. So all of our drainage is above ground drainage to a great extent. And so, I mean, you know, there are decisions that could have been made that would have made negligible increases on anything.
Oh, yeah. You know, and sometimes it's just this idea of leadership. And one of the challenges, right, is mayors are 2 years, city council people are four. The repercussions of not doing anything about these issues doesn't show up for sometimes decades.
Yeah. Right? Yes.
You know, in Lubbock, we now have the what some people consider the highest electricity bills in the state of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that didn't happen overnight.
No. Right.
Right.
That was, and it didn't happen immediately because of this transition to ERCOT. It happened because for decades, we used our city utility as a piggy bank.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Rather than responsibly reinvesting the money,
right?
We used it for a lot of other stuff,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Milwaukee, as it exists today, would not exist if we hadn't used the city's electricity company as a piggy bank.
Yeah.
Right? Over $100 million came out of the city utility, right? So when you think about now the electricity costs that we pay, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul when it comes to thinking about city resources.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those frustrations. And so, you know, put yourself through the lens of the person who's trying to get the Marsha Sharp freeway done,
mm-hmm.
and they're trying to get the Milwaukee build out done. And they're looking at the city budget and they're saying, well, we can't do a bond raise. We have too much debt. We just did the water, you know, the big water purchase from T. Boone Pickens.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to do this? We want to do it. We think the city should grow that way. We should develop that way. The Friendship School District, people like it. How can we make this happen? And so, right, they're just looking around, you know, what are things that we can leverage? Right? What are things that we can, you know, get mm-hmm. money out of? And the city's utility was the perfect place to find that opportunity.
It was painless theft.
At the time. Exactly,
time.
Right?
It was painless. But,
and so, know. Right, and so you fast forward years. Lubbock, we reach a crisis point where the Southwest Power Pool, looking at standards, and they say, Lubbock, you're too much of a taker. Your power generation facilities are way too old. You're not producing enough.
Mm-hmm.
And we have limits in terms of how big of a load you can be on the system without putting anything back in. And so mm-hmm. you either have to pony up a bunch of money to not just simply repair these aging facilities now, but actually build new
mm-hmm.
because of how far behind you have fallen.
Yeah.
Right. You've leaned way too hard into other people's generation resources. And so you either need to now responsibly invest like you haven't, or you got to figure out a different route. And in Lubbock, when we looked at the numbers and crunched all those things, the leadership at the time thought, you know, it'll be cheaper for us to just tap into ERCOT than it is to essentially re-up our commitments to the power pool.
And right? That's another thing that you look at, and you can make the argument that it's cheaper in the short term.
Right.
But 15 years from now, it probably would have been cheaper to build a new nuclear power plant.
Oh, if it was nuclear, 100%. Obviously, that would have been hard to have gotten the money for.
Yeah.
But for that kind of stable generation and that type of power generation, mm-hmm. that would be amazing. But, right, so we joined ERCOT, and there was even sort of different ways that we could have done that, right? And even in those discussions, there was a debate around how we should do it. And I would actually argue the way that we did it ended up being the wrong way. There was really two other options to how we could have done it. We could have joined ERCOT, but we could have kept essentially everybody on the same balance sheet. We could have essentially kept all of the citizens onto one book of business, and gone to the ERCOT market like San Antonio or Austin does, and bid that out. And if you're not familiar with it, if you hate Austin, totally fine. But people in Austin actually pay some of the lowest electricity rates in the state of Texas in terms of the city, the municipality, right? And it's because they have great bargaining power. They have an entire city of Austin when they're going to power producers on the ERCOT marketplace and they're saying, hey, give us the best rate. We're giving you volume here, right? So we either could have came in together as a city and we could have kept using essentially the volume. We would have gotten volume pricing as a community for that. The other option, which was on the table, was that we also could have sold LP&L, right? So most people thought that's what we did, but then all of a sudden you still get your LP&L still there, right? What could have happened is that LP&L's, the wires of LP&L, could have been sold to one of the big wires companies in the state of Texas. So that's Oncor, CenterPoint, AEP, right? Texas New Mexico Power. And you know, there were some of those that had an interest and would have put in a bid if that had been a route that we have chosen to go as a community. But there was this idea at the time of we want to hold on to this, right? Well, what was the cost? So maintaining all those wires, being an Oncor, being a CenterPoint, being one of these wires companies, there's a lot of overhead to that. And that overhead, it doesn't matter if you service 10 million people or 250,000 people, right? That overhead, a lot of that's still the same. And so what happened for us in Lubbock is that all of a sudden we have the overhead of a transmission distribution wire company, right? With the smallest population, right, to essentially pay for that overhead. And so that's why, right, why here in Lubbock we have some of the highest costs in the state is just simply because there's just not enough people to distribute out the cost of the wires part.
So,
right?
So here's, this is a perfect example of like, how do you, why do these things happen like over and over again? Like, is it, who has the ear of the decision makers? Is it, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's occasions where there's fraud, but I think mostly it's just,
yeah, this
maybe comes, not really understood. Like, is there just a general lack of understanding?
Well, it's to me, I put it in sort of this big category of well-intentioned people with not enough time, right? A city like Lubbock, the decisions that our city council make, even small choices, have multi-million dollar implications. And yet they get, what is it, $200 a month for being a city council person, right? Many city council individuals have said, this is a full-time job. If I'm truly taking this seriously, if I'm actually doing my duty as being the representative of the citizens of Lubbock, and I'm really trying to dig into the numbers and make choices here, this is a full-time job. But we don't actually provide that, right? And there are communities our size across the state that do. Laredo oftentimes gets used as a good sort of counterpoint to us, about almost the same population size. But their city council members, it's a living wage, something like 50K, something like that, benefits and stuff like that.
The biggest problem you're going to have when you start trying to make a change like that, which I'm not opposed to that, but you got years and years of history of in the city of Lubbock of them not of making consistently making poor decisions.
Oh yeah, right. But the part you the know, part for me, because these are just flashbacks of city council meetings and things I've been involved in. But you know, the part for me that I never want to hear, and the part for me that hurts, is hearing a city council member second or vote for something they don't understand. I have been in city council meetings where a member will just simply say, I don't even know what I'm voting for, right? And they vote for it, right? And it's just, as a community, I don't want to be in that position.
That is so weird, because that is like so, I mean, I can't even wrap my head around, I can't even put myself in the shoes of doing that. Because I'm like, well, my first thought is, I don't understand this. There's no way I'm putting my name on this thing. You know, that's just the first thing I look at on that. But I mean, it is. I mean, you're 100%. I mean, it's not even the point you were making, but it is a full time job. When you're dealing with if you're dealing with 10,000 people, it's not a full time job. I mean, yes, there's problems, but, you know, a competent city manager can handle that without any trouble. You get to 250,000 people, or more if you figure what comes, you know that's just the population. That's not what's here on a Tuesday.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I just came around, I was coming around the West Loop on the way here thinking, it's three lanes wide, and they need to put another dang lane out here.
There you go.
Oh, it's only for 10 minutes a day, though.
This was at 11. This was at 11:20.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah, like it's, it can't. You know.
So, I mean, it's wild. You look at that, and Lubbock has outgrown a small town.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But and so then you run into the, how do you keep the small town feel with the big city management?
Right. You know, and we. That, for me, is one of the places, coming back to this idea of the benefits of how do you make communities, right? How do you make a sense of place? We're going backwards on that.
100%. Right?
Because the original neighborhood design of Lubbock was Playa Lake Park Elementary School. And the idea was that that was the identity, right, mm-hmm. of the neighborhood.
Of the neighborhood.
Right, this is what this neighborhood is about.
Tech Terrace is a great
example. Oh, yeah, great example. Great example. Right?
We have a, I have a school just two houses down from me, and I absolutely love it.
Right. You know,
love it.
But the challenge becomes, as we've gone through this wave of school closures, is that when you remove the schools from the neighborhoods, what are these neighborhoods becoming, mm-hmm. right? What becomes left there for the, you think about who's interested in owning a home. It's typically mm-hmm. families, right, who want to invest and be homeowners when they have the opportunity
right. yeah.
to. And they make that choice based on schools, right, and access to schools. And so when you get rid of a school, when you get rid of that type of public amenity within a neighborhood, and all of a sudden the idea of, hey, we're dual income household, we both work multiple jobs, they're part-time, the idea of my kid walking to school safely mm-hmm. in the neighborhood, right, mm-hmm. never crossing a major intersection, things right. like yep. that, the relief, it's incredible to think about that. It's like, wow, this problem for me is taken care of
right.
for at least the next 6 years, right?
Yeah.
And in some neighborhoods, the junior highs in your neighborhood too, right? And it's such a big impact on how people think about sense of place. And so in Lubbock, we have great, you know, evidence of this. When the elementary schools disappear in the neighborhoods, home ownership in the neighborhood goes down.
Mm-hmm.
Families, right? The number of people mm-hmm. living in that neighborhood goes down because the families, who are typically larger, right?
Else.
They go somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, you've got less people.
Mm-hmm.
You've got less interest, you've got less desirability, right? And all of a sudden, you end up with a neighborhood that's predominantly rental homes,
yep.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what do you have at that point? You've got effectively a neighborhood that's a dormitory.
Yeah.
Mm.
You don't do anything in the neighborhood, right? All the things that you do, you have to leave it, right? Kids go to school in the neighborhood. You want to go shopping, you go shopping out of the neighborhood. You go to work, you go to work outside of the neighborhood, right? The neighborhood just simply becomes mm-hmm. a place where you happen to sleep,
yeah.
right? There's no connectedness to it. If there was a neighborhood that, you know, you found a better house in or whatever like that, you're gone.
Yeah. Right?
You know, I wonder if part of our, you mentioned this, that we're not a small town anymore. And I wonder if part of it is a lack of understanding of how large cities work, in that people they live in a community inside that city. And I was completely ignorant to all of this until our kids moved, and they moved into the first to leave and to go to a big city. They moved to D.C. And I began to see that they had literally what we had when we were in Brownfield.
Right.
But it was in this big city, but they had... you know, Eleanor and, you know, all these people and everyone at the, you know, coffee shop over here and at this store here and, you know, and now they live in Denver and it's the same thing.
Right.
Like people in their neighborhood know them and they know each other. Now, they don't know everybody in Denver, but that little neighborhood is just like a little Brownfield, Texas inside of Denver.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard for us that have that still consider Lubbock a small town.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I hear people say all the time, oh, I can't go anywhere without seeing anybody. I know a lot of people, but I go out a lot and don't see people I know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really surprising to me.
The number of times I've stumbled across somebody that I know, if it's not at United, it does not exist.
Yeah, you
because,
know,
I mean,
yeah, right.
like I go to the coffee shop. I know when I'm going to go to the coffee shop, I'm going to see these guys, mm-hmm. and I'll go there early in the morning and I'll sit down and I'll have coffee with those guys, yeah. and it's a great morning. But you know, when you look at you know, looking at the school model that you were talking about, one of the things that has hurt the neighborhoods is actually the size of high school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, think about it this way. It's pie in the sky, mm-hmm. Pollyanna stuff. But if you could take one neighborhood, okay, and say, okay, this neighborhood is a square mile. Mm-hmm. Okay, we know where a square mile is because this is a flat country. Mm-hmm. Right. And you just pick the numbered street and the named street and you got a mile. Okay, and in the middle of that thing, you put a 2A school. And you have elementary, you have middle school, you have mm-hmm. high school, or junior high and high school, mm-hmm. all in the same building. And it's a relatively large building, but you have it all in there. It's all administered by the same administration. Mm-hmm. You know, so you don't have a middle school principal. You know, you might have a middle school principal, but you don't have like, you know, 18 levels of administration sitting on top of it. Then you've got that school that's right there. And it's going to be right there.
Mm-hmm.
And then as that town grows, you know, it funnels into that thing. And you no longer have schools hopping on buses to drive to Dallas to play a district football game.
Right. You know, and you know, not right. only that, but, you know, asking the question, you know, is that possible? Is it desirable? I mean, yes to both, right? I mean, that's why people have their kids go to Trinity.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right? Listen,
right.
Yeah. I picked my house because of the resale value of being in the Friendship. At the time, it was, you know, it was like I'm right across the street, you mm-hmm. know, and so, but I also picked it with knowing that my kids were going to go to Lubbock Christian because that's where mm-hmm. my nieces and nephews went at the time.
Exactly.
And,
there you go.
You know, mm-hmm. and it was, you know, I wanted, as coming from that product of homeschooling, I wanted my kids to go to a small school.
Exactly. Right.
That was,
right.
And that was why people sent their kids to Shallow Water and they're sending them to New
Home. That's right.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
to
that's true.
New Home. Mm-hmm. You know, because mm-hmm. it's,
they want that they experience. Want that and I think that that goes back to unquantifiable things that you get when you have a community.
Yeah.
And, you know, people are, we're all of us, I think, feel this sense of disconnectedness because of our phones and AI and all of these things. It feels like we're all still together, but we're all pulled globally in a million directions. And mm-hmm. so it's so much easier to be consumed by problems that I can do nothing about that are happening across the world.
And that, I mean, that alone, you know, because I think about this, you know, I teach introduction to business courses, honors business courses at Tech, and I'm seeing, you know, these are 18, 19-year-olds coming out of their parents' homes for the first time, right, moving to Lubbock, you know, all those sort mm-hmm. of things, stuff like that. And the impact that screens have, right? The way in which that we use TikTok and Instagram and sort of things like that, and the disconnect that people have to their own environment. It's only getting worse, right? And in Lubbock, you know, I'll just give an example, you know, and think about it yourself. Whenever you try to tell somebody what part of town you live in Lubbock, right? And how you describe it, how often do you actually say the neighborhood, right? So I grew up in Remington Park.
Yeah.
If anybody knows where that is, congratulations, right? I happen to know the name of it because I looked it up, you know, quite a long time ago, and it stuck in my head, right, as a result of that. But normally, if somebody asked me, like, what part of town did I grow up on, I'd be like, oh, I was just off of Chicago on 76th Street. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or if they're not familiar with the smaller streets, I'd be like, oh, you know, between just off of Slide, you know, between the Loop and 82nd.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Something like that. Right. I'm using geography. Right. Of the roads and sort of things like that.
I do the same.
Not any kind of identity. Right.
I don't even know what my neighborhood is.
You know. What,
right.
So
most people don't.
Do you wonder then, like, because this goes directly to the original question is. Of the benefit of investing. So we've invested in a voucher system that I think that I can say 95% of the people I know did not want to happen. And so we have this voucher system that...
We know different people.
Well, yeah, but I... So we... I think the people that know, so the vast majority of people that have been using it now are people that have already been homeschooling and already been in private schools. And the data for that's been published.
Yeah.
So I think something just came out. So it's like 300 and something thousand vouchers have been applied for.
Yep.
That is a minuscule amount of, you know, if that tells you, like, most people have said no thank you unless they've already have figured out how to put their kids somewhere else. Right.
It wasn't, yeah. The program has not resulted in being a new entryway for, well, you know, not in a huge way, right? In terms of, you know, seeing who exactly has received these, you know, it just sort of ends up being.
And this is data that's coming out of the comptroller's office, just so to be clear. Like, so it's the state's own data.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think about what if you took that investment and said, let's try something different. Mm. And let's try what Dusty has said here. Mm. You know, like, what if instead of closing this school, what if we find a way to invest in this school and make it where the people that live here, they get to be around their community until their kids are 18 years old. They're seeing the same people. Yeah. They're invested in the same. I know my kids' friends so well.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've known that kid since kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
They get to experience those things that a lot of kids, if they don't live in rural America, they don't get to experience.
Right.
But you could replicate that in a community.
Yeah, absolutely, right? And, you know, I just think of it as these things grow and become more industrial, right? I mean, I hear some people even using, say, the term of, like, super max for talking about high schools, mm-hmm. right? And
yes,
I'm like,
yep.
It's a bad sign
but,
when
okay,
we're, like,
so,
using prison terminology.
Okay, y'all, so that goes back to what I'm saying is, how much of responsibility, based on the preamble, is it for the government to think, our responsibility is not efficiency. It's not to create a factory that just shoots out kids. It is that we are building something that promotes the common welfare mm-hmm. of these students and their parents and their family. Because when those people have a sense of, it's that pyramid of Maslow's hierarchy of mm-hmm. needs, and they have that sense of security of place and they have the people around them, then they have a foundation to live the American dream.
Yeah.
Well, I would say, though, that the current education system, when it was started, is working exactly as it was intended. It is turning out people that will show up at night at a certain time and do a certain job and then leave at a certain time. That's what it's not designed to turn out a huge volume of very highly educated people that have critical thinking skills.
Yeah, well, you know, and
I mean, that's it's. It,
I mean, know, I think that's maybe what it has become
well,
and
this,
is
right,
moving
and
towards more.
It's, and it's also some of the controversy around, you know, what are the long term effects of the Head Start program and some of the changes of, you know, No Child Left Behind, right? Where this idea of saying, you know, we need more rigorous accountability in our schools, right? And it became this whole sort of wave of testing.
You have a huge school, how do you hold people accountable, right? But if I see the person that is my second grade teacher, my son's second grade teacher is going to be my daughter's second grade teacher and maybe my third kid's second grade teacher, what better accountability is that? Because I don't want my kid to have that teacher again, or I want my kid to have that teacher again, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, especially if you incentivize teachers to live in that community, you know? And I mean, I grew up, Dusty and I both grew up, like, public schools are the devil's way of destroying the world. I mean, that's pretty much what we were taught.
Case could be made for that.
And some of us have had enough therapy.
Some of us don't need therapy.
To some of us, ignorance is bliss. But you know, then putting my kids in public school and going, oh my goodness, these people love my kids.
Mm.
These people, like, literally get up every day and do for my kids, even when I it is beyond me what puts that in the heart, so much so that I have a kid that's a seventh grade teacher now.
Yeah.
Because of the impact on him.
Yeah.
You know, and he and I just have, you know, never having heard anything good as growing up, and then experiencing good and bad.
Oh, sure.
Good and bad, but also, you know, recognizing that at the end of the day, it's my responsibility as a parent. But I'm in a position where I have the privilege of having the mental space because I'm not a single mom with five kids, or I'm not working two minimum wage jobs and just trying to get by, and I don't really have the time to think about who my kids are going to school, you know, what's happening to my kids at school.
Yeah.
To me, what Dusty proposed here, which I just have never thought about it, but it's actually just to me such a brilliant idea of rebuilding that sense of community. And, you know, and we hate that, what was her name? Oh, Clinton, Hillary Clinton wrote that book, It Takes a Village. But we have believed that. We've lived that. I mean, you know, growing up, your neighbor is going to call your parents that you did something.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
People are watching each other.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know,
you know, and it's that's the thing is everything that's old is new again, right? This was conceptually, this was how people thought it was supposed to be, right? And that was
this is like the one room schoolhouse,
right?
Type
you know,
of
your
feeling.
Sort of relationship to education, and it, you know, when you think about this industrial, you know, public school education that we have today. It just shows up in so many ways. In the business world, a really big complaint about the Gen Z generation, and if you think about it, so for the Gen Z generation, these are individuals that have only lived in the era of standardized testing.
Right. Right.
They've been tested since they were in first grade, right?
Yeah.
Every educational experience that they've ever had has been aligned with this idea of, okay, this is a really important test, and everything that we're teaching you is with the goal of getting you to pass this test, right? And what happens to critical thinking when your educational system is just simply designed in that way, right? The complaint in the business world is that these Gen Zs, they have to have everything explained to them. Everything has to be spelled out. You can't just tell them to go and do something or take the initiative on something. They want a recipe. They want a list of how I'm supposed to do it. Tell me the right way to do it, right? Rather than trying to figure it out. They don't want to take that type of risk. And some of these things end up getting connected to this idea of, well, when you think about the way in which that they've, their whole life, learned how to learn.
Yeah.
Right? How do they think learning happens? How do they, right? And these things. And it's like, oh, no, the way that I learn is that there's a test at the end, and there's this multiple choice questions, and I get assessed on these, and this is what learning is. And this is how it's determined whether or not I'm good at this or not good at this. And so life, whenever I'm being measured up or assessed or things like that, it's going to be the same.
Right. Got to feel like to them, if you're giving them something to do that they haven't been trained to do, it's got to feel like a trick question.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm going to be tested on this, but no one's told me how to prepare for it.
Exactly, right? If you just tell me how to do it, right? And this to me is this sort of, you know, there's this tension, I think, in leadership styles of kind of baby boomer generation wanting to do it one way.
Yeah.
Gen Zers really respond way better to servant leadership approaches than anything else, right? And just this sort of unwillingness to want to see it through their eyes, right? And to think about, like, just imagine yourself having come through your educational experience, all the ways that you've learned how to do something new. It's been ingrained in you that this is how you do it. And somebody's going to tell you the things you need to know. Somebody's going to tell you how to write all these pieces. And then you just have to memorize it. You just have to memorize the answer. And there's an answer to it all, right? And there's a right answer, and everything else is wrong. And so if you don't tell me the right answer to how I'm supposed to do this, how am I supposed to do it, right?
Right.
How am I supposed to know if I'm doing it?
It's easy for us to forget that when we're frustrated with the things that the generation behind us does, to forget that we were the adults making the decisions about the world that they were going to grow up in.
Right. Yeah.
And, but yet we blame that generation you know, behind us for the way they choose to do things.
When congratulations. I'm like, welcome to how it's been since the dawn of time.
No, exactly. Yeah. Right. But I miss the days where it was just avocado toast, you know, was the thing that people hated.
Argued over. Yeah. Yes.
Like,
yes.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, don't, you know, it's like, you'd be well off if you didn't buy Starbucks coffee, right? Or whatever,
right.
Like that.
Yeah. And
I'm glad we've gotten beyond that. You know, it was a simpler time of gripes.
Oh my gosh.
But I mean, it's, you know, and that's the thing, you know, it's so disheartening sometimes to look at it and realize that every problem is insanely complex to fix.
It is.
And
it is.
Everybody that's in position to fix it is only interested in a soundbite.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's all they know. But I wonder sometimes, too, part of it is that's all that we are going to listen to. Because let me tell you something. I can put all these things on social media that have good, it's good, valuable information. If it's longer than 30 seconds, if I put a 30-second clip up, 10,000 views.
Yeah, I don't.
You know, and so it's like, how do you
compress it? It's hard for me to, I mean, I know that's a thing. I mean, I know 100%.
Yeah, but you and I are readers,
it's a thing. But I'm like, yeah, I mean, I was looking back and I was disappointed. I only read 200 books last year. I was like, man, I'm like falling down on my job. In COVID, I hit 400. So, I mean, you know, when you don't have anything to do but read and go to the farm every now and then, there's nobody to talk to. But, I mean, you go into that thing and you're just like, you look at a problem and you're like, okay, what are the possible solutions? And then it goes back to defining a value to something. Mm-hmm. Okay, how do you, you know, you look at everything that I've always looked at as a scale. You know, you look at which is my better option. You know, a lot of times that scale is pretty close to balance and it really doesn't matter. But when you're doing something that's going to, like, let's just say for an example, the next subdivision that gets built in Lubbock, the city of Lubbock and LISD says, you're doing it this way.
Mm-hmm.
And we're plopping a school right in the middle of it, and it's going to have, you know, K through 12. So I'll be in the same building. You know, we're not going to have gym. We'll have enough gyms for PE, but we're not going to have gyms to host games. That kind of, that'll go, you know, to a central location. Whatever. But we're going to be, but and it's going to be this big. Here's the footprint of it. It's going to have a field out where, you know, they can play, you know, recess. You can have recess, mm-hmm. and you go back in time,
mm-hmm.
and you set that, plop that in there, you know. How do you look at, okay, well, if we do that, that's going to cost how many hundreds of millions of dollars?
That's what it always comes back down to.
It's
going to
cost,
yeah.
I mean, if I had to pull a completely wild guess out of my hind parts, I'm saying, okay, that school is going to cost you $100 million to make. The new high school in Brownfield was $23, $35 million, something like that, for a high school, a 3A high school,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so you're like, okay, so we're going to plop that in there. Mm-hmm. And granted, you might could do that in that same size of building. You might could do what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. Don't know if you could, but you might could. Mm-hmm. But if you did that, and then you're like, okay, well, we've got all the teachers in here, and then we've got this stuff, and it's going to cost, the overhead's going to be X. Okay, and I think Texas spends, what, $20,000 a year, student?
On average, right? Yeah.
On average,
yeah,
$20,000
a year?
Yeah. It's like, okay, so that's substantially more than a private school.
Hmm.
It's twice what I...
Depends on where you go.
It's
true.
In Lubbock.
I do not believe there's a private school in this town that costs $20,000 a student.
Wrong.
Well, okay. the other thing I've got to say, though, too, is like you've got to... When you think about that top-line number, you've got to break it down and thinking about... you know, so this has always been a big critique, right? Children with special needs.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And accessibility
that's the
issues.
Most people that have turned back their vouchers.
Exactly right. Accessibility issues, mm-hmm. sort of things like that. Private schools, they are under no obligation whatsoever to provide any kind of needs-based services, sort of mm-hmm. things like that. And so when you see that kind of top line number, what's getting baked into there are a lot of extra costs, which I think are appropriate, which is that the, you know, I wish these were things that privates also had to do, right? And I think that would be more fair, because you end up what ends up happening, right? Is you end up with a family who, say for example, they want their kids to go to private school, but mm-hmm. you know their child has ADHD or they're in a wheelchair, God forbid, And the private school says, you know what, we don't want to deal with that. Like,
or we can't. We have to remodel our whole building. No, exactly.
Right.
Or whatever.
Right. We have accessibility issues or things like that. Yeah. This is just not like.
Even if we wanted to.
Yeah. Right. And they just reject that outright. And it, to me, it's sort of like, well, if this is if we're thinking about this as a marketplace, if there's privates and publics, right, in a marketplace, right, there's certain elements here where they should be playing by the same rules when it comes to access, right, and what it is that people can have.
I think that goes back again to the question, original question is, are there some things that our government that we vote in, the people that we vote in, this government that works for us, are there some things that we should not be looking at them as through the lens of this is a corporation, mm-hmm. and it's required to make money turn a profit or to at least pay for itself.
The classic element here, right? Because the simple statement, right, is like, why don't we just run government like a business, right? I'm going to run government like a business, right? Well, businesses don't have forever obligations, right? Mm-hmm. A business doesn't have a forever obligation to community, right? If you ran the city of Lubbock like a business, right, what does that mean about the next generation, right? And how are we even integrating them into a business model, right? When it comes to how are we thinking about people who are going to live here 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now, mm-hmm. right? You know, the nature of planning for a community, absolutely, should your bottom line balance it out, sort of things like that, 100%. But when you take that concept too far, right, you end up thinking about, I heard this through the grapevine, some of the educational programming that is provided at the day centers here in Lubbock, right, for seniors and sort of things like that, people that were providing services to there, they had a meeting with one of the city staff in community development, and they were told that they're not charging the seniors enough money for their services, right? So these are people who are coming to the day centers, doing things like art programming or stretches, right?
Well, let me tell you something. My mom went to one of those. Yeah. If they raised the price, I mean, she probably won't go back because it was expensive.
Exactly. Right. No, exactly. Right. And that was the thing. So this was not a problem, right? Nobody was having an issue with this, right? The people who are providing these services knew that they were doing them at a lower rate because they wanted people to have access to them and sort of things like that, right? And then you had this needs to be run like a business come in. And say, you're actually not charging this retiree person with mobility issues. You're not charging them enough money for the stretching exercises that you're providing to them, right? You either need to charge more or we're essentially going to get rid of this program, right? Mm. It was the same conversation when it came to the city runs a couple summer camps that are actually really well attended and used for low-income folks in the city of Lubbock. And some people don't even know this, right? And they were crunching the numbers, and the city was saying, "We're not making money off of this, right? We're not making a profit off of these camps." And it's sort of, okay, maybe you're not making a profit outright, but when you think about the family that is able to essentially have a job in Lubbock right. and work in the service industry and as a bartender or a server or whatever like that
in the summer,
because they can have their kid right in a day program that they can afford.
Walk in the streets.
Exactly. Right. Right. And it's sort of like the public safety element of that. Right. Mm-hmm. You have to think about you have to take into account a bigger picture of what a community is, right. Than a business does. Right. When it comes to thinking about a bottom line. And there's certainly absolutely parts of a city that should be run like a business. There are other parts of it that if you take that lens, right, the ultimate result of that, the story that's already written, it's you just get rid of all of the benefits. You get rid of all the public amenities.
And the other thing, too, is that it's different. Is you do a customer analysis. Who is my customer? When you're building a business, like that is one of the biggest things that you do, and you know this well, is who's my customer? And you've got to know that customer. Well, the government is like every single customer. I mean, it's like every customer is my customer.
But you walk a line in there, though, because you're like, money is a finite resource, mm-hmm. and money is not generated by the government. The government does not make a dollar. They get it from the taxpayer. I mean, with very few exceptions, the NASA deal you're talking about is an exception. They produce a service that is used by private business, and they pay the private business.
I think we also own, like, huge chunks in different businesses now. So I think it's about to switch.
The era that we're in now is different, right? We own, as citizens, a part of Intel, right? Which is a funny thing to say
But the statement still holds in the grand scheme of thing. The business, and so a city has. Honestly, they have a fiduciary responsibility to the taxpayers to be as wise with their money as possible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, when you look at it and you say, okay, you were not very wise with their money here on that. And, you know, there are people that have been in Congress for, you know, 40, decades. 50, 60 years. And you're like, and they're complaining about how much spending there is. I'm like, well, dude, you voted for all of it. You've been here since we had a last balanced budget. You know, what are you talking, why are you complaining about it now? You know, but you look at the city and you're talking about, you know, where does our money go? You know, that's what it boils down to. Where does money go? And it costs, you know, like you were talking about the last time we were here, it's $1 million a mile, a lane mile to pave a road. Now, it's $1 million a lane mile. And you start driving through the city of Lubbock and hit the odometer and just start driving. Drive for half an hour. Don't cross it. Don't go down the same street twice. See how many miles there is, and then start doing the math on that.
Right.
It's a math problem.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest problem is that it's a math problem. And when you get to a pull, I mean, you say, okay, I have to have a street. You know, we can't not have streets. You know, so, okay, well, that's going to be this huge chunk of it. And, well, you know, we've got to have the water. Well, that's another huge chunk of it. You know, and then you're like, okay, well, do we raise taxes? Well, you know, we're already, I mean, we're not as high as I thought we were.
No, we're pretty low compared to a lot of other places.
I mean,
Yeah, right.
And these are, I'll just say, in Lubbock, we've had knockdown, drag-out fights around road maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
And because for a long time, and still there are people that will say this, you know, with a straight face, is that we should use debt to finance road maintenance, right? That road repairs and things like that. The way we should do it is every 10 years, we should do an absolutely gigantic bond, right? And mm-hmm. take on a ton of debt rather than trying to actually do that, right, through our budget.
Yeah.
And the thing about that is, you know, can you do it that way? Sure. The trade-off is how much extra you pay in interest, right?
Yeah.
And the trade-off's your future.
Right, and this is only getting worse. I mean, the 30-year Treasury bond, if you saw this in the financial news just today, highest it's been in decades, interest rates on the 30-year Treasury bond, right? And when the Treasury bonds are that high,
right.
Muni bonds, right? If you're a community and you're trying to attract interest, things like that, right? That means rates go up for everybody, right?
Yeah.
And so every, you know, in this period, and there's really no end in sight for this from an interest rate standpoint right now, right? We're essentially saying, yeah, this is just only, not only is it getting expensive because of inflation and the cost of materials and labor has gone up to make roads, but the financial engineering that is necessary to get this money has become more expensive, right? And so it just ends up being this sort of double whammy, right? And so, you know, there's been so much pushback because it's not, if you're a politician, it's not sexy to spend money on road maintenance.
No.
Right? It's not a new initiative. You don't get to cut a ribbon somewhere. You don't get to put your name on a new road or sort of things like that. Right? It is a very unsexy thing to dedicate your budget to. And so, you know, whenever it's something that, you know, how are you going to be held account for it? Right? Roads come up for maintenance every 10, 15, 20 years, depending on wear and tear, right? Mm-hmm. Or
for the access road off of the South Loop at Quaker, that one pothole is always there.
Right. And, you know, and there are some places where, like, some areas that bother me where it's, you know, and you can see it. It's like some business has got their sprinklers going and they're dumping into the street all the time. And I'm just like, that, mm-hmm. I'm going to have to pay for that, man. Like, stop having that water in there because it's like, you know, you're mm-hmm. cracking the roads, right? They're breaking up the roads, you know. These are the challenges, though, is because when you're a politician and you're asking, like, what are wins? What are things that I can do? How can I show my community that I'm doing things and stuff that's visible and things like that?
Roads, you know, don't make that list.
Exactly, right? Pothole repair doesn't make that list, right? And so as a result of that, it's just not something that's really on your radar. Yeah. And then especially because, you know, every city council, you know, from the engineering department, from the city manager, they get to see the numbers on like what our road liabilities are, right? But those numbers are just so startling and large, right, that it just feels impossible, right? It just becomes out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. like, well, wow, that's really big. Well, I'm only going to be here for 4 years, so.
Oh, let somebody else do that.
Exactly, right? I'm going to, right, especially for the mayor, where it's every 2 years, it's like, yeah. Oh, wow, that's an enormous number. That's going to be really bad for whoever's next, right?
And, unfortunately, it's everybody that does that. And right, six of them down the road, all of a sudden you're 12 years down it, and everybody said, man, that next guy's going to have it hard.
Yeah,
and the next guy looks at it and says, oh, that next guy's going to have it really
right.
hard.
And what happens is you lose your Coliseum, right? You lose your municipal auditorium. You lose your electric company, right? Because of this kind of kick-the-can-ism around, you know, what it is that, how are we going to take care of the things that we have, right?
I think that is so important because it does tell, you know, when we don't take care of the things that we have, it does say about us, like we're hurting in some way. Mm-hmm. Something's not well here, you know. And you know, it's always great to see, you know, beautiful new things go up, but it's also really disheartening to think, what is that going to look like in 50 years or maybe less? Because are we going to take care of what we have?
Right, and that's why whenever I say, you know, you think like, oh, you know, we should make some types of investments that benefits our community. That's why I'm sympathetic to people that are like, well, but there is this part of who's making the choice of what we're investing in and how we're doing it. And is that responsible? And is that for our best interest? You know, because we, going back to controversy, Citizens Tower.
Right. Yeah.
Is a really great example of that. The Omni building, mm-hmm. that thing was bad, right? That was falling apart. You can find news articles of mm-hmm. parts of the siding
falling off. Yep.
Right?
Yes.
Like could have killed somebody, right? Like just like absolute, what a clunker. And, you know, that property had so many zoning violations, so many ordinance violations, so many liens placed on it, that the city could have been within its rights to essentially impound that property, right? They could have effectively been like, we're just taking it off, right? Instead, you know, there was this whole sort of process of, first off, the person that owned it happened to have some good friends, right? And such and so forth. Right? Surprise, surprise, right? But, you know, we end up as citizens paying a very large, you know, a very inappropriate amount of money for the building mm-hmm. as is, right?
Yep.
And then we go through the process of, you know, this sort of next element being like, oh, we need a new city hall. That what a great solution to solving that. Well, now with the renovation stuff like that, that building, right, and its infrastructure and how it was built, that was not a great design, right? When you go into city hall and you go into the offices upstairs and things like that, how claustrophobic it is, the pillars and where all they are, that was not a building that we should have renovated for this purpose, right?
No.
That was, you know, there really was sort of a better way to approach this. And then, you know, the planning of it wasn't necessarily great. A couple years ago, the basement of it got annihilated by flooding, if you remember this.
Mm-hmm.
It was a huge added expense. that sort of came from that because, like, a stormwater door or something like that had been left open. And the whole sort of thing just got flooded. But it's just one of those things. I know that there were people at the time that were making these choices that thought this was an amazing win. There's an eyesore downtown. We need a new city hall. This is a big building. We should just renovate it. This, you know, the simple story that you can tell yourself there is like, oh, this was totally right. You can see why people bought into the idea. But as you know, as the wheels were set in motion, right, and sort of each stage of that being like, oh, this is not in good condition at all. We are ripping this thing down to beams, right? Like almost nothing remains of that, of the original building, right? Aside from just the barest of infrastructure.
When they bought that thing, I remember being downtown and I was looking at it and I'm thinking, why would you buy that thing?
Yeah.
I mean, especially if it's like the city should have just impounded it, leveled it, and then built something on top of it.
Yes.
Would have been money ahead and it would have been modern.
Right, exactly.
I mean, now let's, you know, do some nice architectural work on it and make it fit in and, you know, be something unique and cool, but not like, you know, something that looked like it came from Star Trek. But, I mean, you know, that would have been money way better spent.
Oh, yeah.
That was the biggest complaint about it was everybody was saying, that's not a good way to spend that money.
Right.
But again, it boiled down to who's making the decision and who they know.
Right, and that's why,
the golden rule.
Right, and Citizens Tower, for me, it's a great example as to why these conversations are so tough, is because some of the biggest, like, most visible situations that we've been in as a community in terms of public investment trying to, right, be beneficial to people. Some of these most visible things in the city's history, in recent history that we've done, mm-hmm. have really backfired, right? In terms of trying to say,
it's but okay. So, like, when we look at this, and we're kind of running down on time, I don't know how we've already yapped for an hour and 21 minutes, but we managed to pull it off. So when you look at, like, you're talking about the Citizen Tower, and that needs to be named after somebody, so they have to bear the shame of it.
Oh my gosh! You know that the funniest thing in the world to me is the fact that there is this horrible toxic lake south of Midland, and it's called Lake Craddock, which is the Railroad Commissioner's. They've got a big sign out front that looks like Textop Building.
Yeah. But where I was going with that was to try to bring some cheerful to it. But was if you could point to one thing that has been done, and it's like, hey, this is a good use of our money. This is good. What would it be?
Burl Hoffman Soccer Complex.
Yep.
That was, some people didn't want it. And it was, there was some money had to go into it. But you could see not only just the benefit to the local community, something, if you have kids, you know this, but if you haven't had kids in a while, they're gone or whatever, you don't necessarily know that Lubbock is the nexus for youth sports in this mm-hmm. area.
Yep.
And the utilization of our baseball fields, our soccer fields, or sort of things like
fields,
that.
Even the private owned volleyball stuff.
Right. Oh, exactly. Yeah. Right. That these things have enormous impacts on the community, and they're great benefits to have. And there were people that thought this isn't something we should be investing in, right? And
that's a relatively low cost. I mean, the price tag was, to me, the average salary man, I think in mm-hmm. Japan, salary man, it was a big number.
Right.
But when you look at the bang for the buck on it, astronomical. I mean, it's the best money. I'm out there with you. I think it's some of the best money that the city of Lubbock has spent in a long time.
Another one that I'll give a lot of flowers to former council member Randy Christian on this one, McAllister Park. Mm-hmm. So this is like Marsha Sharp mm-hmm. and intersection of like Marsha Sharp and the Loop, that wedge sort of space.
The dog park.
Dog park, right?
Yes.
Exactly. There's a very popular dog park
park.
There's
another dog park in this town that I like more than that one, and I'm gonna gatekeep that
there
one.
There you go. Okay, fair, yeah. But it's a very popular dog park. The city does invest in it, try to maintain mm-hmm. it. Obviously, it gets ripped up all the time, so it depends on when you go, what it looks like. But that area, right, the investments that are going into it to create that, right, you've got the baseball fields mm-hmm. also there as well. You have an amazing milestones, that amazing facility for kids, and it's developmental needs friendly, right? They have all mm-hmm. different types of experiences there, which is
there.
Right. It's really cool. Mm-hmm. And there's still a couple other sort of big picture things that, to get done out there. And I love that. Seeing those developments. Do I wish the neighborhoods over there? Do I wish that they all had their own little parks? I do.
Yeah.
But we can't go into there and fix that, right? And so this is about the next sort of best thing is like if we are going to have just one big park for the area, let's chock full it with.
Let's make it good.
Exactly right. Yeah. Good experiences, for families where they can envision the idea of like, what are we going to do on Saturday? We'll go to McAllister Park, and we can actually spend the whole Saturday there, right?
Yeah.
At least the amount until your kids are tired, right?
Yeah. That's. Wow. I mean, that is a good one. That's that's one that's over that. I drive past it every day.
Oh yeah.
And was completely drawing a blank on McAllister Park. Mm-hmm. I know what. That's why you're giving directions. I'm not going. Okay, that's there.
Yeah. Exactly right. You
can, but I mean, I used to take the kids when it was the wooden structure
legacy.
before it got mm-hmm. completely vandalized and destroyed. And
that was a bummer. Yeah.
I mean, that's so frustrating, but that's is what it is. But
that is another thing. And I saw that Lubbock Lake Landmark is rebuilding their trails yes. from their vandalism.
The, exactly. Yeah, shout out to that. Lubbock Lake Landmark, also another wonderful place to take your wonderful kids for a little place. Outing. They have these scenic so walking cool. trails. They have very effectively rewilded parts of it, so you mm-hmm. can, you know, you walk through there and you're truly seeing landscapes and animal life that are very similar to what would have been out here before us. Really pretty. But yeah, somebody vandalized it. They took a vehicle into that area. Yeah, and they ripped
like
up.
Like an off-road. Yeah. Was it a, I thought maybe it was even a golf cart or something.
No, it was some kind of car. Yeah, but yeah, they just yeah. and really, you know, and just sad, right? Because it's like, why would you do that, right? It's like, it's not easy either. Yeah. They had to right. essentially get through the fencing, and then they just went on this sort of very terrible joyride that ripped up, you know, the walking trails and things like that. And
did they catch the guy, person that did it? The people that did
I
it?
Want to say that they did. I believe so that they did, because if I'm remembering the story correctly, I think the vehicle was left behind.
Oh my goodness!
And so I think they ended up like being able to sort of find it that way.
So it was a smart. So when you're looking at that, you're like, okay, they left the vehicle behind. You're like going. Okay,
Darwin
so you had an idiot doing idiot things at like an idiot. But, I mean, it's, you know, but anyway, Lubbock Lake Landmark's so great. Yeah. I mean, I don't think I've ever walked the trails, but I've been through the building. Mm-hmm. And just the amount of stuff, which I thought I knew a lot of stuff until I walked through that. And I'm like, holy crap, I didn't realize that was here.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's amazing. And there are some good stuff. It's just that it's a shame that the errors are just so blatantly glaring.
Right. Yeah, and so it's like, and that's for me, it's what's tough is I'm trying to find things to love, and sometimes it feels like you're finding them on the margins, right?
Yeah.
Of sort of things to love. But no, you know, you can get me excited about a lot of stuff. I mean, I love the Arboretum, love mm-hmm. that area.
Oh,
right?
I do too.
I love the pumpkin events and you know, mm-hmm. during the fall. I like that Moe's Market has set up there. Mm-hmm. So there's a if you don't know this, there's a farmer's market now at the Arboretum on the weekends. Mm-hmm. Follow Moe's Markets on Facebook if you want updates on that. But I just love what, you know, the things that's happening there. And it's like all this grassroots stuff, right?
Yeah.
It's
it
just
is.
Like, you know.
Yeah.
It
so,
is because there's,
really
I mean, honestly, I mean, and I'm not going to throw it just like, say, with the city council. But Lubbock government. As a whole.
Well, also, let's remember how many people voted in the last election.
Ooh,
hey,
yeah.
I will tell you, I have not missed a vote, missed voting on an election in the 20-some-odd years I've lived here. So, I mean,
same
I just
point.
Don't miss them. I figure, you know, me and four other people are going to elect the next mayor, so let's go for it.
You know, you joke about that. It's so true. Go back in Lubbock's history. The number of, like, 1, 2, 3 vote, right?
Yeah.
There is a substantial number of, like, the history of Lubbock that was determined by 1 vote,
yeah.
2 votes. Like, it's that's true.
But what I was getting at, and I'll close out on this, is saying they've earned the distrust that they have.
Mm-hmm.
It's been well earned.
Mm.
And when that's what makes it so hard when somebody that comes in that's like, hey, let's do this. And you think, on the surface, that's a good idea. Where's the hook?
Mm-hmm.
Where's the sticker in there? Where's the, you know, where's the bat that's coming from the back of my head? Who do you know that owns this land?
Right. No, and I'm sympathetic to that, right? You look on Facebook, anytime that there's a new announcement that one of the news groups cover, without fail, there are multiple comments being like, who's financially benefiting from that, right?
Always.
Like, exactly,
yes.
Right.
Well,
and it's like,
almost always true.
Right. Right.
That's what's so sad
the
about
culture,
it.
Right. And it's just like, and it's just, how do we break out of that?
I don't
know.
You know how you break out of it? You don't let it happen for
a
couple of times.
Someday,
just
okay.
A couple of times.
Someday, I want us to have someone on that can talk about why we have so many banks in Lubbock. Someone told me one time from another part of Texas that they refer to Lubbock as Laundry Lubbock.
Ooh.
I was like, interesting. We do have a lot of banks. Does that mean we have a lot of money or what?
There's a lot of money. There's an impressive amount of money that runs through this city.
There is.
There really is.
You know, there's an impressive amount of money out in the world mm-hmm. right now. There really is. And I think that it's a good time to find good things to do with it. And there's folks out there that want to do that. So
yeah.
It's just a matter of finding them. But Dusty, close us out.
Well,
It's 1:30. Nick.
It is 1:30. Nick, thank you for coming back again.
Hey, thanks for having
it's
me.
It's always great. We'll always. There's never enough time when Nick's here.
Never, ever enough time.
I appreciate you.
Yeah, but, and we once again forgot to give the phone number out. We never can remember to give the phone number out.
Oh, one God, of these days we're going to remember to give the phone number out when Nick's here.
You got to let me come back. I want some call-ins.
We've got to have some call-ins. Maybe we need to do something really controversial so that people will call in.
Your kids are banned from calling in.
My kids are banned.
But anyway, we'll be back next week with another rousing rendition of the Dry Side Dispatch.
That's right. Todd Ballman will be back. Next week we'll be officially like 2 days away from some of the highest leadership in NASA visiting Lubbock. And that is going to be super exciting. And everybody's getting all ready for that. And maybe we can talk about that some.
And we'll be less than 2 weeks away from the opening day of dove season, which means
and
it's
that's
the start
even
of fall.
More important.
There we go.
That's right.
Thanks for listening, guys. Appreciate
it. Bye.